Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Hospice News Elevate podcast. I'm Holly Vossel, senior reporter for Hospice News. In this episode, we'll be talking about the future of health equity in hospice. With us today is Henry Mason Jr., founder and CEO of Precious Hospice. The Atlanta-based hospice is dedicated to delivering compassionate end-of-life care to underserved communities. Raised on the south side of Chicago, Henry's journey into healthcare began when his mother was diagnosed with cancer for the second time. The experience opened his eyes to the lack of Black representation in hospice care and the limited options available to those in underserved communities. Henry graduated from Morehouse College and founded Precious Hospice without outside funding support. He educates and advocates for health equity through his social media platform, Healthcare Henry. Through the platform, he connects with communities on the importance of hospice care and equitable healthcare access, and he advocates for patients who have been harmed by the healthcare system. Today, we're discussing how immigration policy changes have impacted hospice's ability to both improve healthcare disparities among underserved patient populations and also hire and retain a more diverse workforce. We'll be talking about the effects of several executive orders that were rolled out in the United States in the past year related to the increased immigration and foreign policy enforcement. The enforcement activities have sprawled across the country, resulting in sometimes serious impacts such as families being separated, clinicians facing deportation, and increased instances of discrimination, violence, and even the death of some protesting individuals. And with that introduction, we'll begin our journey to today's topic. All right, Henry, so I want to start off with a genuine note of thank you to you, Henry. We're really grateful that you can be present today and that you're able to give your insights on our podcast topic.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Holly. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I would like to give just an introduction first off to Precious Hospice and some of the driving forces that led to its launch, which I believe was 2014, if I'm correct, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'd love to. So 2014, my mother was going through her second bout with cancer. I like to think of us as the people-driven hospice. And where that comes from is 2014, my mother worked for another hospice. I didn't know much about hospice at the time, but I did know that she said that she worked for one. And so between, I guess, call it maybe March to about August or October or so, she was going back and forth for these chemo and radiation treatments. And finally, I just said to her, Mom, you know, this job that you say you work at, where are the people? Like, no one's come to see you. Well, one person, she did come. Mm-hmm. No one's come to see you, check on you, owners, nobody. She said, well, you know, I've been contemplating that as well. And I said, well, this is a healthcare company. Now, at the time, I had heard of hospice, but I didn't really know what it was or what it did. Mm-hmm. She said, yeah, so it's a hospice company. I said, okay, well, what do you want to do? Because you can't go back to a company that can't even take the time to come check on you in 8 months. And she said, you're right, I'm not going back. I said, well, what would you like to do? How can I help you? At the time, I was doing a staffing company up in D.C., government contracting. So mm-hmm. I was prepared to see what she was willing to do and willing to get behind it. And she said, we can do this. We can start a hospice. And I said, absolutely not. I am not doing that. Once she told me what it was. And just like most minorities, I would say the word scared me. It was very morbid. And I was like, I don't want to be involved in people just passing away in a day or two. Like, I didn't want to do that. Mm-hmm. So she called my grandfather, who at the time, the way my family works, you talk to your granddad and he gives you a call and he said, hey, you're going to start this hospice. And then he hung the phone up. And so what that means in my family is you're going to do what he told you to do. And there's no questioning. This is a true story. It's in the book, actually. Like, you do not go back and forth with him. And so that's literally what happened. So from there, my mother and I, she was going through chemo treatments and continued radiation. And I went on and started the business. And my background was in finance and programming. So we went on and did that. And she wrote most of the policies, you know, on her chemo bed. And we had a couple consultants kind of walk us through, you know, some of the policies and things. But that's how we got going. And everything mm-hmm. kind of stemmed from that. We chose the name Precious Hospice because we felt everyone had, like, gotten around these Latin names or we thought were like robotic names, and it's just nothing felt genuine and loving and passionate. And Precious did that for us when we heard it, and then we chose the color purple, and implemented these purple bears because we said, well, purple for us is it means royalty. And if you know anything about the origin of the color purple, back in the day, everyone couldn't get it. It was very expensive to make, and only those of royalty could get it. So we felt like all of our patients were royal family to us. So we did that, and my mother loved bears, so this ended up being the mascot, a purple bear. And I feel like every time I give one away now, it's just like a part of my mom that goes with her because she passed in 2022. But we've been growing the company ever since. You know, it's been its ups and its downs, but for the most part, through social media and people just resonating with the story. And being a healthcare company in today's times, whose people first, profit second, it truly makes a difference.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that story and that background and the introduction.
Sure.
I think when I ask that question, I'm always prepared for the story that goes with it, because I think there's a lot of personal and professional reasons why people get into this space. So your mom definitely made a mark, huh?
You know, it's funny. My mother, so from 2022, January, my dad, April 2022, my mom, and last year, my granddad, all on my hospice. And, you know, it's one of those things where even we did it for people, but until you go through it, right? And my mom having cancer again, and this time when she did pass in 2022, and not wanting me to help her get changed, and you know, she, you know, had to use incontinence supplies and want me to change that diaper. I was like, oh, I get it now. People need more than two CNA visits a week. Some people genuinely need 5 to 7.
Right.
And I think it takes that to really understand what it is that you're supposed to do to really help people.
Man. And I think it's this sort of, as we're talking about in this episode, you know, that the future of health equity and hospice, we're really kind of examining things that are happening now, and we're talking about the impacts and the outlook ahead of us. And I think that what we're talking about today, we're just kind of examining some of the recent policy, immigration, foreign policy changes that have occurred. Particularly in the last year, we've seen these executive orders rolled out that have increased regulatory enforcement around immigration, citizenship, customs enforcement, border protection, and some of that has had some definite impacts, I think. And that's what we'd like to talk about today, is how that's impacted, you know, diverse cultural, racial groups of not just patients and their families, but the workers themselves as well. So let's get your two cents on that first.
Love to. And you know, I have a lot of opinions, as you know, Holly. You ask me things, so of course.
Yeah. So what do you think that some of those policy changes, how have they impacted, you know, the hospice space for workers and for patients?
So I'll do workers first. It's a patient's one is still going to be a little long winded. But for workers, I think a lot of people focus on doctors and nurse practitioners or RNs. And yes, there are a lot of them who are not necessarily from America, but where it hurts hospice the most are our aides. So CNAs, sitters for some people, hospice aides, roughly 30 to 40% of them are going to be impacted by this type of ruling. And it's just super important because we were in a deficit before this, right? So now you've made it so much more difficult for us to actually go out. And I look at a lot of these immigration policies and the idea that someone told me once, well, they're stealing our jobs. And the reality of it is, these aren't jobs that a lot of Americans really are even wanting to do. Mm-hmm. So now, if they were just stealing your job, then the job would have, for one, we wouldn't have had these vacancies. But now that we can't use certain people, we shouldn't have less vacancies. You all should be stepping right into those roles, which isn't happening. So what I'm seeing is that's on one side is the aids. The other part of it, which is where I have the most concern, borderline panic, if you will, is because when you help diverse communities across the country, particularly in the South, we have a lot of patients from different backgrounds, different ethnicities, and while anyone can take care of everybody, I do understand that. And I agree with that. But it does sometimes help relieve certain families when there's someone there that has some of the same cultural understandings or at least baselines that they have, whether it be religion, whether it be food, whether it be in some instances you don't actually talk to the wife. There are some cultures that we've taken care of people where they're saying, no, you don't talk to the wife. You talk directly to this person. And so those things you don't know, right? So being respectful of the families and understanding that, it makes a huge difference. And hospice, for the most part, people are passing away. And I think them being, they'll be as comfortable as possible around people that they can resonate with, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I've heard that as well be very important to having representation, you know, and culturally informed care. And that those are very important things, and that's been a concern as some of these regulatory enforcement actions come around, that some providers have heard, you know, patients are afraid to seek out care if there's risk of a deportation or something. Even among clinicians themselves are facing some of these things too, not just those hospice worker aides or those in roles, as you mentioned, that where others might not be so, the whole taking away the jobs argument. There's also clinicians in those clinical roles as well who are worried about some of these changes.
I agree with you 100%. And, you know, even when, to that point, is the idea of taking away jobs and, you know, even at any level, right? Again, people do focus heavily on doctors and nurses. And yeah, that's important. But they're not the ones who are doing the brunt work, like the actually getting in there with the patients in the homes. They're not doing that 5 days a week, right? A nurse might go once or twice a week. A doctor probably once every 90 days. So it's not something that they're not doing the grunt, like the force of that work. And so when you take away those people, one, you're actually putting the patients at risk because we don't have anybody to do that. So we have to go out and hire people to do that. And then on the flip side of that as well, I look at the people who come over here for opportunities and the way that the ecosystem, it works the way that it should have been working. And what I mean is because you have a lot of people who fill those gaps of those jobs that Americans just didn't want to do. It wasn't really about pay, right? We, in my opinion, well, not my opinion, we pay more for CNAs than I believe any hospice that I know of by far, right? Maybe 15 to 20% more. But it's not about the money. It's a job that a lot of people just don't want to do. And they come over and they do this job with such a love and such a pride to it. And I think a part of that is too, they're more used to taking care of their seniors in the home. Where in America, we have nursing homes, we have facilities. Like, they don't have that in a lot of places. So they understand this higher level of acuity. They understand what it takes. They even understand how to move patients and use leverage, things that, you know, you learn in CNA school, but you really learn through experience. So we miss a lot of that when some of those people, you know, are no longer able to kind of have those jobs, or you're charging us $100,000 per visa. It's just not realistic.
Yeah. And I think other things I've heard on the patient side are that, you know, there's barriers that exist around underserved patient populations already. Some of those, beliefs around death and dying and how they might differ. Sure. There's, you know, mistrust of the healthcare system has been another factor, I think, in that, you know, gap of unmet needs among underserved. So I think as we're trying to think about that, and when it comes to this, the sort of regulatory policy changes, that's what kind of goes through my mind as far as how are these changes impacting issues that have already been in existence, you know, are, yeah. So any additional thoughts, I think, as we look at the staffing side of things, as far as how hospice providers like yourself are really navigating challenges around related to recruitment, retention, and supporting that representation and cultural inclusivity in your diverse workforce. How do you think is a good way to navigate these challenges for hospices? And what are you doing at Precious Hospice? And then what kind of advice would you give others?
So the first thing I would tell people is you want to hire the best people. That's the number one thing, right? And you know, just being honest. And a lot of, and since you're asking me, a lot of these DEI policies kind of make it as if people weren't hiring, you know, the best people, and they were just giving people opportunities because of these policies that were put in place. And reality is it's quite the opposite. Mm-hmm. The people that you bring on, particularly for healthcare, and let's just use hospice, I'm 99% of the time sending someone into someone else's home, right? Mm-hmm. It's not a, you know, people don't understand how much control you don't have in someone else's home. It's not like in a hospital or a facility where we can control that environment. We can't control everything that goes on in someone's home.
Right.
So we're only sending out the best people. It doesn't matter where they come from or what they look like or what language they speak. And that's the next thing I want to get to your point. A lot of this is a language barrier, right? And so they have these programs set up where, well, you can talk through a phone and it will translate it for you, or you can talk through Metaglass and it'll translate it for you. And it's like, yeah, you could, you can, right? You can, but someone is looking to be as comfortable as they've ever been in their life. Right. Do you think they want to talk to me through a telephone? Yeah. It's these things that they do for policy. And I've said this multiple times, if they would just call us, like if someone would literally just pick up the phone and call me, I could really help them navigate these things, because not understanding this language barrier piece is huge. Mm-hmm. And I think as you talk about hospice, a lot of things are being put in place and they're looking at hospices more. And at the same time, the same administration is telling us that they want to save Medicare dollars. And hospice is, I love to fact check this, the number one Medicare dollar saver probably since it's of all time. You would think about how much it costs per day to put someone in the hospital,
mm-hmm.
or to go back and forth to the hospital, whether it be an ambulance ride, the time in the hospital, the test that you're running, the doctors that are coming.
Yeah.
It's insane. It's insane. Mm-hmm. Or you tell, and by the way, that's just in the hospital. You know what else mm-hmm. they have to do? They still got to pay for their medications. They still got to pay for everything else that they need. Whether that person can go home at hospice, and then we pay for the medications. We pay for the supplies. We pay for the equipment. So we are, for me, the biggest money saver. And so when they're not doing everything they can, then they have to, you know, what is it that they're really trying to accomplish here? We just did some research, and it says research indicates that hospice enrollment saves Medicare approximately $3.5 billion annually by reducing high-cost hospital services, which is insane. Insane. If I can't sign these people up on hospice because of a language barrier, you know what they're going to do next? They're going to call an ambulance ride, go to the hospital, get sent home, go back to the hospital, get sent home, go back to the hospital. And you know who's going to be the most upset after all of that? The hospital.
Yeah.
Because now your readmission rates.
Mm-hmm. So really kind of selling the value proposition of hospice would be a better way for that diverse workforce.
It's a no, you know, for me, right? And I've done this now for 12 years. And because my background is in finance, not in healthcare, mm-hmm. I can say hospice makes the most sense for everyone involved. The hospitals, the insurance companies, the government, and the seniors or people who need it. Because it is such a task to be sick and feel like you still got to go back and forth to the hospital, back and forth to the doctor, figure out how to order these meds, or God forbid you can't get in and see your doctor for a month, versus being on hospice, I can send somebody out in an hour, mm-hmm. right? So it's all of these different things. So when you take away the ability to bring in people who speak the same language as these people, a lot of times who look like them, that's what makes them comfortable. Mm-hmm. There's this little thing too that I love that some of my CNAs do. It's this like little food, right? So certain cultures, I'll use the African-American culture, that there's this thing, they love fried chicken, right? It's just what it is. And I have a CNA who's just like, I'm like, man, what is this that you keep? He says, Henry, my people love fried chicken. So I'm going to take them fried chicken. And I'm always like taken back by how much that really means to the families, right? Mm-hmm. They understand where they're coming from. They understand the things that they love. And so that for me means it's one of those things you can never really look past. But how do you hire more diverse workforce? I'll be honest, until we get to a place where the administration understands how important they are, we're just basically hiring whatever we can find at this point. So we're begging for people to come be CNAs. Mm-hmm. And then the other barrier for this too is they have to go to CNA school, right? Yeah.
The cost factor.
There's a cost, right? It might be $100,000 to be a nurse, but people don't understand. It still might be $2,500 to be a CNA. Mm-hmm. So if you don't have, and you have to go every day in a lot of cases for 3 to 4 weeks.
Right.
So you have to get the money, keep your household up. I think we've sponsored 2 or 3 people to go to CNA school so far this year. So we're looking to do more of that. That will obviously help us and help other people who need CNAs and help the CNAs themselves. But it's going to be very difficult to attract people to come to hospice when they're looking for a company who at least can send a CNA who speaks their language and no one has anyone. Right. I think that's one of the things we have to really look at and try to figure out together.
Well, I think it's that diversity is lacking in both hospice utilization and representation, right? The reports show that most of Medicare decedents who have passed away using hospice are white patient populations, and that any other group outside of that, it is only 20%. Using right now. And I think that there's been a lot of conversation about how do we move the needle there? How do we ensure safe, inclusive, equitable access? How do we make that more, accessible to all, and a benefit that all see as beneficial at the end of life? Because there's different cultural beliefs, different spiritual beliefs among every group. Is how we see death and what we view as a quality end of life. But I think a lot of it, what I've heard the most of, is that, having some kind of community liaison, community education, have that line of relationship building among these different diverse groups is really key. Would you agree with that? What are your thoughts on that being an important part of improving health equity?
Holly, this is the second time that we've talked, so I'm going to assume now you know how I think, right? So, and I'm gonna give you something, and this is the truth, and no one's gonna be willing to say it, but I will say it. It's not just about the liaisons, right? That's one part of it, but nowadays you have people who do research, and the research says, I want to know who also owns these companies, who's on the board for these companies, and so. You have to be open, and they have to allow people of other ethnicities and different races to have better access to opening these companies. And once I believe that will better solve the problem. You made a good point, right? And you didn't say African-American, but I will, right? So what that means is a lot of them don't trust the healthcare system in America. I don't think we have to kind of guess on that. That's a fact. And so they choose practitioners who look like them. Mm-hmm. And so they also are going to choose hospice companies that look like them. Now, there have been, and I've said this before, even with that, even with us and what we've done in Atlanta, you have other institutions that have figured out other ways to still try to redirect people. But even that is doing more harm than good, right? Mm-hmm. So I think one, you need to have companies owned by different types of people, I think is super important in healthcare. And there's enough for everybody to take care of certain people. I think that's important. And I think once we get to that point, because it's not a hospital. And I know people are going to say, oh, they don't do that in the hospital. That's true. But that is a very controlled environment. And when you go into someone's home, that is a whole different type of situation. And so I think that would truly be more of a benefit to the healthcare system overall. And something that we really need to take seriously in terms of helping people get these companies going, because it does take about $300,000 to $1 million+ to open up a hospital. So most people, they don't have that, right? Like, how did I do it? I did every job but nursing, right? Literally, So, I just think that we need to be able to do that. We need more women-owned hospices. that, and that for me is a big one too. We really need more women-owned hospices. And when I say that, I mean 100% women-owned, because the sympathy, the love, the compassion that mothers have, that women have, that they can portray in healthcare, would be a phenomenal help to so many people. So taking a lot of the profit out, putting more of the people first into the programs, I think it would be phenomenal. Mm-hmm. But that would solve a lot of the problems, though.
I think having that representation at the leadership ownership level would make a very big difference, too.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. People want to know who owns it. That's just what it is. They want to know.
Well, I think that transparency is key as well to that point. So I think on our kind of final bring us home kind of question that we have here is the crystal ball question, right? What can hospices be doing right now to prepare for any other changes that or impacts on the horizon related to, you know, foreign policy or immigration and health, so, and how that kind of relates to health equity?
Health equity is this huge subject, right? Mm-hmm. It's really a lot that goes into that and what it looks like for different people in different parts of the country. For hospice, one of the things that I'm taking a hard look at are Medicaid patients. I'm really concerned about Medicaid patients.
It's like dual eligible patients. Yeah.
It's one of those things where we're already seeing a lot of them are being dropped. No one's talking about it. And they're making it more difficult to stay within the program. And people who weren't working are barely working now. And now you're expecting this family of four who make $40,000 to be able to afford healthcare. It's an unreasonable ask. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people who don't have access to quality care will now be looking at hospice as essentially just a way to live out their lives in those last few months. I'm very, I hate to use this word, but I am actually very afraid for a lot of these people. Very afraid, because the way hospitals have lost grant funding, the way nursing homes have changed from rehab and long-term care to just pretty much only want to rehab patients. Those long-term care patients, if we're being honest, a lot of them were homeless patients. Like, right, they didn't have anywhere to go, but they had Medicaid and they had a high level of acuity, dementia that kept them out of having to find memory care facilities. Because those are $6,000 a month now. No one can afford that anymore. And I feel like, and I hate to say this, hospice has to get a hold on some of those people, because they won't have access to a lot of curative measures, but at least they can get some comfort in their homes. Mm-hmm. Then the flip side of that, because I know what people, how they talk to me. But why would we do that if they don't have insurance? Right? That's the next thing. You've got to force these hospices to take on more indigent patients. That has to happen sooner than later. Our indigent population normally is going to be around 10%. So for every 100 people, you're going to have, 8 to 10 that are indigent, right? And pretty much all the time. So you have to force that on hospice companies, because if you don't, they'll just not take people that they should be taking. And that really is going to be a huge problem, because now more people have less access to healthcare. Then they're going to be at home with no one to take care of them. And it's going to just really, in my opinion, it's going to take this nation to a whole other level if we don't do something about that fairly quickly.
I think you've given us a lot of food for thought here, Henry. Thank you for the thoughts you've provided today. I know we're not talking about an easy conversation, to say the least, but your time and your candor are really greatly appreciated. Thank you for being a part of this podcast today.
Thank you, Holly. Anytime. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. Well, that brings us to the end of today's Hospice News Elevate podcast. A note before we go that we encourage and invite others to share their perspectives on the podcast airwaves. Let us know if you or others are interested in participating or sponsoring a podcast by reaching out to us at editor@hospicenews.com. Once again, I'm Holly Bossel, Senior Reporter for Hospice News, a WTWH Media Company. Thanks for listening to today's Elevate podcast, and stay tuned for more episodes. Take care for now.